for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 562 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week it's another great doubleheader episode featuring conversations with Gerald J. Jones and Edmund Truman. It all kicks off with the return of Gerald J. Jones from Driver 8. His Kickstarter is supporting the third episode in the series, so be sure to support The Strange Fate of Driver 2 on Kickstarter after you hear this episode. The book is described as the spine-tingling 30-page third issue of the comic book science fiction epic. Alien abductions, ghosts, and staff turnover, oh my. Then everything wraps up with author and illustrator Edmund Truman, who explores the story of the Congo in this comprehensive graphic history, Postcards from Congo, now available from Arsenal Pulp Press. This book brings the country story vividly alive, and it's highly recommended. There's a lot to get to in this episode, so let's get on with the show.
Yes, it is I, your guide to the grotesque, Gary Berry, with a twisted tale of torment that will completely chill you to your bare bones. The Strange Fate of Driver 2. This supernatural tale of horror will feature alien abductions, cyber ghosts, and worst of all, smart aleck AI assistants. I'm getting too old for this.
It's always a pleasure to talk with Gerald J. Jones, creator of wonderful things, including the Driver 8 series of comics that right now has a Kickstarter going on for issue number 3, The Strange Fate of Driver 2. I don't know whether to put the dot in or not. Sometimes I do and sometimes I don't. How you doing, Jerry?
I'm good, Wayne. Thank you for having me back on.
It's always good to talk with you. So let me read the description real quick. People get so mad at me if I don't say the vital statistics right away. The spine-tingly 30-page third issue of the comic book science fiction epic, Alien Abductions, Ghosts, and Staff Turnover, oh my. And, of course, the vital thing is this project will only be funded if it reaches its goal by Saturday, November 19 at 7:43 p.m. Eastern Time. And of course, as we're talking, you've already met your $500 goal and you're beyond that by the time this posts, I'm sure you'll be even farther along. So congratulations, Jerry.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
It's always good to see a science fiction thing move along and do well in Kickstarter, and we get to see a lot of it. So this is issue number 3. So talk about the issue. It may be better to start off, I guess, talking about the series, just in case somebody hasn't heard your previous interviews with me.
The series, it centers around the main character, the eighth recruit into the driver program, Paul McGann. And so he's driver.8. What the driver program is, they recruited loners of video game players and introverts into a program where they kind of a virtual reality type program where they go in to a simulation that's designed to train AIs like, Siri or the Amazon Echo or, Microsoft Cortana, or just basically AIs like that. And they have the avatars of real people in there. And since the simulation can't ever be shut down because they have all these expensive AIs wandering about, glitches will pop up. Anybody who's ever had a computer on for too long knows that eventually they've got to restart it. But they can't do that here. So the driver agents, they go into the simulation and they take care of the glitches and such, which appear as like ghosts and UFOs and things like that.
Now, why they called a driver, just to clear that up?
Because I thought it sounded cool.
Okay. So they're driving cars around, too. Of course, that has something to do with it, I guess.
I try to go for like a computer term. In computer jargon, a driver is a program that makes other programs work or makes some hardware work. Mm-hmm. Like a driver for your printer or a driver for your microphone or such.
Gotcha. And of course, in the third issue, which I got a chance to have a preliminary look at, Jody, the partner, actually wants them to be referred to as agents, which I thought was an interesting thing. They run into a person who tries to call them Men in Black, and of course, she's not up for that, so she prefers it to be called agents. So that's kind of an interesting way to do it.
Yeah, they're actually called driver agents, but yeah, since in the simulation, the AIs, they don't know that they're AIs. They think that they're people. So the rule one of the driver program is they can't divulge that the AIs are computer programs, and they can't, divulge who they are, that they're, the fix-it men trying to fix the problems. So.
Now, one of the things that's really interesting about this issue is you start off with a narrator.
Yes.
And he's got some interesting stuff to say. He says, "Welcome, creepy kitties," is the way that he welcomes people. And then he goes into he's the guide to the grotesque, scary Barry with a twisted tale of torment that will completely chill you to your bare bones. He starts off saying, and I thought that was kind of cool. Who's he based on? Is he based on somebody you know, or is he a new character or what?
Barry, originally he was supposed to kind of cameo in my one project, Blank Walls, but we never really got around to being able to feature him. So I moved him to a Driver 8. I always liked him as a character just because he's kind of fun, and he's a little bit more than he appears, as we find out in the issue. And but just a fun character. I based him a lot off of Nick Cave, the singer, as far as his appearance and just some of the mannerisms Nick does on the stage, not necessarily Nick himself, but the character he portrays when he's up on stage. So, and then also a little bit of Larry from Three's Company mixed in there too. So,
okay. Because he starts off trying to do one of those scary laughs, and in the middle of it, he breaks into a coughing fit. And then he says in small letters, "I'm getting too old for this," which made me laugh. That's a very funny phrase. You set the tone, I think, for the rest of the issue really well. I thought that was a great way to start off.
Thank you.
Little bit of humor, a little bit of scariness involved. So it's really good.
Thank you. Since it was going to launch in October, I kind of wanted to do a horror theme, and kind of even a throwback to the old, Crypt Keeper, Tales of the Crypt comics. And, we have one of the rewards actually has an homage to that with Barry on the cover.
Yeah, I'm really kind of curious as to, I don't want to spoil too much, but there's some really interesting things that start to happen. We right away start to see a gray.
Yes.
Do stuff like that. And of course, the grays always spooked me out. So when he got to that, and of course, the way that the coloring is particularly good, when he's actually trying to move a person around, and it's a really dark room, but you see these bright green, like almost finger-like lights that go around and pick somebody up. It's actually the guy that we meet later on. We see him, and he's there, and I was kind of spooked by that. To go right back to the scary stuff as soon as we get into this person's bedroom.
Yeah, my artist, Jorge Gabato, he just did a phenomenal job on this issue. Can't say enough good things about him. Like I say in his bio, I think he's part machine because he's always doing something and juggling two or three products or projects at once, and every one of them turns out phenomenal. So I just don't know how he does it. I don't think he ever sleeps.
Oh, man. They always say give something to a busy person and they'll get it done.
Yes.
So he's kind of that way about that. He's all of his stuff is just, it really fits the tone of the story so well. Really, really cool. And of course, on page two, there's this wonderful question about how do we define what is real in our reality? And then the next question is, if something is considered fake in our reality, would it still be just as fake in an artificial reality? Okay, boy, that might got my brain working there with those good things. That's really, really interesting stuff going on. And then, of course, we see the sequence where they're putting the guy back in his bed at night and stuff. So so that's really has a lot to do with what's happening right after that. So really, really, I love good science fiction that makes me think, and that the yearbook does that. It even starts off doing that really well. So I thought that was a great way to go.
Oh, thank you. You know, I knew I kind of wanted to have fun with this issue because next issue is not gonna be quite so fun for everybody.
And then we get to something that really shocked me. We've got a character who is bright green and obviously a projection or an image. And of course, he says to the little gray who's putting the person back in bed, just stop. And the little gray goes, or what? In case you didn't get the memo, you've been canceled, pal. And then all of a sudden he reaches around and he hits him. Yeah. And the little gray is sitting on his backside going, that's not possible. And I was sitting there going, yeah, that's not possible. How did that happen? So I love when something like that surprises me and I'm going like, now what? That's really great. And then he even asks him, I don't want to get too far in the book, but are you even real? And the response of the image is, I don't know. And I'm sitting there going, wow, I really don't know what's going on now. It's really good stuff. I mean, I love of course, his eyes shift from green to red, the little gray does. And so, really something special. I love when something makes it that I can't figure out what's happening. Right. You're already on page three and I'm baffled. So I think that's great. It's just a great bit of writing.
Thank you.
It's a lot of fun to do. Now, just, I don't want to spoil too much, but who is the person, just in case somebody needs to know, who's the person that's the image? He's died, right?
That's Driver 2. And, he's definitely had a strange fate about him, as the tale of the story is titled as. We kind of find out what happened to him, and we don't exactly get into why he's like that so much, but at least not in this issue we won't. But it's we'll get a little bit more reveal next issue as to. The true fate of Driver 2.
Now, I love the fact that the helpful, quote-unquote, AIs are there. And there's a wonderful sentence where Paul is saying, she's woken up on the wrong side of the hologram every day since the meteor incident. And it made me laugh because, the AIs are supposed to be, in most stories, AIs are very stolid, and they don't have a lot of emotion. But let's just say that the little AI in here is quite it's like, it reminds me a little bit of Alfred in the Batman movies. She's very much sitting there going, says, "I'm not your social coordinator." She goes, "Text them, but somebody back yourself," and stuff like that. And she is just funny as she goes around, very witty stuff. And the poor guy, I feel sorry for poor Paul. He puts his head down on the pillow, and almost immediately the call for him to go back to work comes back. And yeah. Poor guy, I feel so sorry for him. Paul is the human aspect of this story, and so I felt so bad for him. There he is trying desperately to get some sleep, and of course the AI is just saying, get up, what's the matter with you, you got to go to work, and just fun stuff. He's a very average guy. I think I've talked about that, is that Paul is he's more like us, like as if we were in the situation. He's not like a superhero. He's not even like Peter Parker. He's very average as a guy, and that makes him all the more relatable. So I think he's a wonderful concept and a wonderful story to a person to build a story around.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I kind of wanted just an everyman, so to speak, just, you know, something that, you know, who's like us. He's going to have his heroic moments, and he's going to have his moments like in the first issue where he falls completely flat on his face when he thinks he's having his heroic moment. But yeah, I just wanted just a normal guy to kind of, you know, one that people can relate to and see through his eyes. And then, you know, two, since, you know, we're going to have such crazy things like, you know, AIs that talk back and superintendents that are narrators of creepy stories about UFOs and such, you know, just something to kind of ground, you know, the reader so it's not all in the fantastical.
I have to say, there's a funny bit that made me laugh out. The proxy gives him a drink. And, of course, I happen to like black licorice. I'm one of the few people that I know that does like black licorice. And, of course, she gets him a drink, and he goes, ah. He starts to spit it out. He goes, black licorice, pina colada, proxy, I hate you, he goes. And I was going, gee, that black licorice sounds good to me. So I got a kick out of that part of it. You know, he's trying to recover from it and just go. And then, of course, right after that, we go back to the driver, too, and he says, ghosts and aliens and black licorice, scary stuff, kiddies. And I had to laugh at that, too, because that was a wonderful bit. Because, like I said, I'm one of the very few people I have ever run into that likes black licorice. And so I can understand when people say how scary black licorice is. That was funny stuff to me. Really nicely written. That was a good bit of see, again, there's that. It's a Keith Giffen-esque kind of way to do things. You know, you can be very serious and have very scary things going on, but at the same time, you can be funny. And somehow the scary makes the funny funnier. And I really think that's one of the strengths that you have, particularly in this series, having the funny be super funny, but then the scary be super scary. You know, a panel or two apart, which I don't think everybody can do. I think that's a real talent that other people would love to have. But I think that's something you do particularly well in this Driver 8 series.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I love Keith Giffen. I loved his Justice League. And that's, you know, that's part of how I fell in love with comics was his Justice League writing.
Mm-hmm. It's wonderful stuff. And it's just... You know, I don't want to get too far into it, but they come into the guy who and start talking to the guy who wants who she corrects and wants to be called agents, but we get his backstory, which was kind of interesting. This guy, and of course, I don't want to get too far into it because I don't want to spoil stuff. But there's just this wonderful bit when he's talking, they start to think, don't laugh. Do not laugh, because he's talking about some very far out stuff that's even far out to them, yeah. as agents. And it's just there's so much stuff I'd love to spoil, but I just don't want to, because it's just great. And then let's just say the proxies don't stay quiet when they're supposed to, and things kind of go a little out of whack. And of course, he doesn't like the appearance of the proxies, the other human, and that leads to the next step and stuff like that. But one of the things that we get to understand very clearly in this issue is that being a driver is a really tough job, a difficult job. You know, Paul's always worrying about, you know, can he make it, can he do it and stuff. But then we find out that his partner Jody also kind of struggles with that. And I just thought, you know, we always see like James Bond and he's so cool and smooth and everything is, you know, is so easy and stuff like that. It's nice to see a change and see these agents have to struggle and have to figure out what to do and face the fact that sometimes they're just not always up to it. So I thought that was a brilliant bit of writing, particularly in this issue.
No, oh, thank you. I like to, you know, again, keep characters grounded where I can and, you know, you or I, we would, you know, if we all of a sudden went on our jobs, were, you know, thrust into just a super schedule where we didn't know when we'd be able to sleep, you know, we'd be like, man, is this really for me? Is this what I want to do? So, it's, you know, definitely been tough for the last few weeks since, you know, the meteor incident just really just messed up the simulation with all the power drains and everything. And all the driver agents have just been, you know, going crazy trying to fix stuff.
And then, of course, we run into situations changing around them. Again, I don't want to spoil stuff because there's really good stuff that happens towards the end of the issue. But let's just say Paul doesn't always get to work with the same person all the time. And by the end of the issue, not everybody survives, interestingly enough. So I just thought that was really a nice, I like that. I like being surprised, and this book really surprised me. I really like that.
Yeah, I really try and write things so it's not predictable, and that if, you know, even if something is kind of predictable, it's not going to be predictable in the way people think. You know, and I really hope that I've left enough clues for the big reveal in, you know, the next issue, the season one finale, as I call it, the first four. You Are Not Ready is the title of the season, which is, you know, at the bottom of every cover. But yeah, I don't like to, you know, something that you can see from a mile away. I really don't. That just ticks me off more than anything. I mean, I'm a better guesser at, you know, plot points and stuff than most people. But, you know, something like on, you know, certain television shows, like if I can see how it's going to end in the first episode, then that just annoys me to no end.
Oh, I used to watch a show called Heart to Heart.
Oh, yeah.
And it was... it was so nice to see a happily married couple on television that I put up with the dumb plots. They would start off with something, and by the first 5 minutes, I could tell you exactly how the episode was going to go. And I would often do sometimes is switch channels and watch something else and come back at the end and see the ending I knew was coming. And I would go, well, okay, that was – the good news is I didn't spend a whole hour watching it. I got a couple of things done, but – I'm like you, though, I guess. I don't want things to be too easy to figure out. I want things that make me actually think about what I'm seeing. And your book is doing a great job of that. As I'm looking through the book, I have to just kind of smile at some of the stuff that's going on. And we should talk about this. At the end of every issue, you have a fun page, which is kind of an advertisement of sort. And we find out a little bit something about what the Grays like about Earth on that page. And it made me laugh out loud when I was reading it. And a certain advertiser is probably going to try and say, hey, we need money for that. But it's really, really, really a great fun whole sequence with that. And gosh, those pages themselves would be worth the book. But the rest of the story is really good too. But these are really hilariously funny. You've done this in other ones. This one is, I can't spoil it because I want people to enjoy it. It's tremendously fun. What happens in there? It takes place. I guess one thing we could say, it takes place in a 7-Eleven type setup.
Yeah,
and it's great. I have to say, I love a book that can, like I said, make me be horrified in one panel, and then a panel later make me laugh out loud, and that's what this book is. It's it's good.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that is one thing I've learned, that, you know, if the higher you put someone, like if they're, you know, laughing one page, and the more that you reveal for the, you know, the horror for the next one is going to be, the more the gut punch that'll be. So I really try and take that lesson to heart and, you know, make you laugh once, but then be like, oh my gosh, the next, and then, you know, the main reason I write drive ratings just to entertain people, because I really don't think there's enough just plain entertaining comics out there. Either there are interesting ones, and then there are ones that I consider just $5 advertisements for movies. I think there are way too many of those, but we won't go into that. Otherwise, we'd use up all our time. But yeah, I just want to bring something that's entertaining, thought provoking, and fun, kind of how like I feel comics used to be. So, and unfortunately, the letter page wasn't ready yet for you to preview, but I think you'll enjoy that when it is done. And I try to have a letter page in every book, and have a ad for Mostis snack cakes and cupcakes and things like that. And, the person, the aliens are at first interacting with, that's our founder of the company, Limitless Comics. That's Anthony Moore there. So he got a big kick out at seeing himself there.
It's really well done, and it's so much fun to see the things that are going on. There's some of the previews, by the way. If you go to the page on Kickstarter, several of those opening pages are there.
Yeah.
And so if you want to see, and also you've got a variant cover for a couple of variant covers for number three. Several of them. In fact, it looks like four or five of them. Wow.
Yeah, I always tell myself I'm not really going to do very many variant covers for Driver 8 book, and then I end up doing a lot of covers for Driver 8 book. Kind of like I tell myself I'm not going to get the new iPhone every year, and then I end up doing it. So I just need to not listen to myself.
Well, it's funny. It's a great thing to have and to do these good things, and to make a story that's really kind of gripping. It keeps me going. It's a real page turner. I don't, because you can change tone from panel to panel. I don't know what you're going to do, and I need that. Even comics, like just like with Heart to Heart, there's some books I pick up and I can start reading it and I can go, well, I know what's going to happen next, and
yeah.
Oh, one of the worst things that comics do that drives me up the wall is when the last panel of the book is the cover.
Oh, yeah.
So I know what's coming based on the fact that I've seen the last panel of the book. And that drives me up the wall screaming when people do that. So luckily yours don't do that. I'm really grateful for that and doesn't do it. Because, I just couldn't take that. But who did the variant covers, by the way? Because there's at least three or four of them.
Jorge did the main one. And then he also did the Tales from the Crypt homage, and then I did the other ones. The Monday one where you've got the giant alien creature, which is my favorite too. The giant alien creature in the background, and in the foreground you got the really 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 tiny Paul just going, "Why me?" we've got kind of a Picasso-esque Paul, and then we've got another one of the meteors coming down, which is kind of an important motif. I think we'll learn just a little bit more next issue why quite they're so important, even when we keep mentioning them. So.
And then there's another cover that I'm trying to remember the book that it's high, it's aping or homaging to. It's got the which one's that based on? I kind of forget.
Yeah, that's based on the old Tales from the Crypt or House of Horror. The old EC comic, horror comics.
Mm-hmm. Really, really good. So do you sell many of the variants? I'm just sort of curious about that because I love having variants, but I always worry that they may not sell as well as a regular cover does. How does that go?
Some variants sell better than others. Last issue, we were very fortunate to have Sandra Cole do a cover of Proxy for us. And, that sold better than anything else. And I've been trying to get her to do another one since,
I was reading through the pledges here and something made me laugh. The $18 one is for a blank cover, and the text made me laugh. It's a blank cover. I love that. That's great fun because blank covers so many people love blank covers because they want to get somebody to draw on them and stuff like that. Of course, I don't want that. I want to have the original and just use that. But that made me, that just is a wonderful bit about that. How do blank covers sell for you, speaking of which? Do they sell well?
You know, this is actually the first one I've done a blank cover on.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Tony, he does blank covers with all his books, and they sell pretty well. But yeah, I was just curious, so I thought, hey, I'll offer one for Driver 8 this time, and we'll see how it goes.
Cool. It's very cool, because it really, those kinds of things. Now, is it going to be a virgin blank cover, or are you going to have the masthead on it?
Yeah, we'll have the masthead and all that, and then kind of the black boxing, like on all the other covers on it, too.
Oh, cool. Very cool. That's going to be good to see. And, of course, you've got all different... I love the one that's the whole shebang. For the completionist, get all issue variant covers, the cover bookmarks, and this is, or he'll just not croc. We do have some standards here, mind you. And then there's a really good one. This is a creative one that I don't think I've seen this before. It's you on the cover. For $145, have you ever wanted to be on the cover of a comic? Now, I've been in a comic. Somebody put a thing in there where you could get yourself drawn into the inside of the comic. And I was able to afford it, and so I put myself in there. It was a zombie Moby Dick book.
And oh, nice.
I ended up being part of the crew on the zombie ship that was chasing the zombie. And of course, I wear glasses, and so when I looked at the book, I didn't see me. I said, "I don't see me in there. There's nobody with glasses." And he said, "Oh, well, that's because you're not wearing glasses." And he pointed me to the page. I went, "Oh, there I am," and I love that. And I have to say, it's a wonderful thing. You treasure that when you get to actually be part of it. So you get this, you get 10 copies of you drawn on the cover. And this is done by your artist. He's going to do the drawing of the person. How many of them are you going to do?
As many as people, you know, people will pledge for. You know, Jorge, he's, like I said, he's a drawing machine. So, you know, if we get 100 pledges for it, he'll do all 100, and he'll probably get that done in an hour, knowing him. So,
The thing is, at the end, it says, what's more, you'll get 10 copies of it, and the related, you get an 8x10 poster to give out to any loser siblings who always rub their success in your face. Who's successful now, Bob? You have way too much fun with this stuff. It's just way, way, way too much fun. And then the next level, that one made me laugh too, is the whole shebang, chips and a soda. That is good. Then you as a driver agent. Talk about that one. It's $345 for that. But boy, is it worth it. What's the deal with that?
You get to be an in-canon driver agent, not guaranteed to be alive or dead. And the last, we did it with issue 2. That was one of the rewards. And, you know, the guy who pledged for it, he's actually – Driver 2 in this, so that's him. And so it's his strange fate of what happened to him. Like I said, you're not guaranteed to be alive or dead. You might even be something in between, and I guarantee that I'm gonna have fun with your character no matter what, and hopefully you will too.
Really great. I think I've never heard of that before, so that is a real — that's a great thing, because I've seen people in the books, but never seen them on the cover before. So this is going to be the blank cover with you being drawn on it, obviously.
Yeah, pretty much. It'll be – well, I mean, it won't necessarily be, Jorge just taking a blank cover and drawing on that. It'll actually will be a printed, 10 printed books with the cover he draws for you on it. And then
wow.
10 posters of it. And, just for the listeners of the podcast, I also include, 10 trading cards as well. Of a little extra secret that I generally don't tell people, but I'll reveal it on the podcast here.
Oh, wow. Great. Well, I hope people take up on that, because that looks like fun. Gosh, 10. So you get 10 copies of it. Wow, that'd be fun. Yeah, I would wave that around people's faces. That's probably why I better not do it. Because I would want people to see that on the cover of a comic. All the people say, oh, not comic books. You like comic books? And I feel like saying, do you ever watch the Avengers movies or any of that stuff?
Yeah.
So I always get a kick out. But that would be wonderful. I hope a lot of people take you up on that because that would be a fun level to do. How did you come up with that? Did somebody suggest that or was that something you came up with?
You know, I don't really remember. It's something that we've done and, Tony Moore might have suggested that to us on our Realms Kickstarter, the first one I did with him, because I actually did some of the covers then, the you on the cover. I don't do a lot of art just because I don't have the patience like most artists do. I was originally going to do Driver 8 myself, and then I just discovered, I really don't have the patience to do sequential paneling. I can do, covers here and there, but I just don't have the patience. And I'm just really amazed at those who do. I'm in awe of their amount of patience.
I'm also in awe of their talent because mine would be glorified stick figures. Would be if I was trying to draw it. I'm just not a, I'm not a good artist, so that'd be a big mistake for me to try and do that. So that's why I have to appreciate the artists on this book. So good, it really does. It has that wonderful ethereal feel to it that I like so much. I love that kind of spacey, not quite normal. But the very different kind of look to it. And I really enjoy that. I think that the artwork is always so good in these books. I really enjoy it.
Yeah. Jorge, I just can't say enough good about him. And he's definitely someone you should follow on Facebook. Anytime he puts out a new project, he'll always, put it out on Facebook. And he puts out a lot. So if you like his art, then you'll definitely be spoiled for riches, as they say.
So he does Dragon Whisperer, Tales. Oh, he also worked on Tales from a Dead Astronaut. Well, that's good to know.
Yeah.
That's a good book. I like that book. And No H2O. All kinds of wonderful stuff on there that he's busy doing. So I like the drawing of him with he's got a Spock eyebrow up. So he's got lots of good fun. It looks like he's got a Flash t-shirt on too.
Yeah.
So, my goodness, he's just all over the place. It's really good stuff. So that's going to be good stuff. Let me once again say to people, this is going to conclude on Saturday, November 19 at 7:43 p.m. Eastern Time. And you want to make sure to get in before that. Don't wait until the last second to jump on board. There's a lot too many people do that, and they say, oh, I missed it, darn it. But don't miss it. Do it now when you get the chance. Get done listening to this interview. Be sure to go out there and support it. Just go to driver.8, issue number 3, The Strange Fate of driver.2, and you'll get there right away, and it'll be great fun, I think. I think you'll even enjoy. You'll probably get a kick out of just the covers and the panels and the pages that are provided right on the page. So it's so nicely done, so good. I just this book just always kills me. This needs to be an animated science fiction type show. I would love to see that. It would make me laugh out loud during the whole episode.
Oh well, thank you. I'm hoping that we'll be able to do something to cross mediums with it once we get a little bit further into the story. Maybe about halfway done, I'll start soliciting it out to different places.
I'm just curious, though, who designs the guns? I don't think we've talked about that before, but even in the video, the still shot, it looks like he's holding up a gun. It almost looks like a projector of some sort. Who designs the guns that the agents use? Is that, did you say Jorge a gun and he does it, or do you have some idea what you want it to look like? How do you guys do that?
That's pretty much Jorge there. He'll come up with something, and he'll come up with something he just tosses in on a cover, and I'll be like, oh man, I need to use that. I've got to use that in, the next issue. And, I'll use that in the next issue. And, there's one thing that he put on for, you'll see in the preview for issue 4. I'm like, oh man, that's too good. Okay. That's definitely going to go into issue 4. he just did a cover of Barry and then something else with Barry that we never discussed. And I'm just like, that's just too good. That's going to go in there somehow.
See, that to me is the ultimate marriage of writer and artist. When you suggest something and then he comes up and throws it back at you and you go, oh man, that's so good. I got to use that as we go down the road. And I think that is the ultimate comic book pairing when those kinds of things take place. So I'm glad to hear that. That's so much fun. It must be fun when you get the pages from him, when you get to see what things look like.
Yeah, definitely. You know, it's always a surprise. Like issue two, the doctor and the nurse, you know, we never talked about them being, you know, kind of having the teddy bear robot look to them. I just wrote them as just robots, but he added that completely. And I'm like, that's just perfect.
Yeah, that's so good. Do you guys, you're not in the same place. So obviously you can't get together for lunch or dinner and sit and talk about it. Do you do that over like Zoom or Skype or something? How much do you actually get to talk about the book besides, you know, the script and stuff?
What I'll do is I'll write out kind of a little guide for the issue if it contains unfamiliar characters or new things, and you know, kind of just throw off a couple of you know, photographs of something, kind of what I've got in mind. But you know, mainly I just let his imagination just take fold. And you know, I find that, you know, unless something's just completely necessary for, in my mind, for the scene, I just leave it up to him as much as possible.
He probably appreciates that. That's pretty
good.
Yeah,
because I try and balance it between that and then, you know, okay, this has got to be in the top right corner in the foreground with a worm's eye view and, you know, stuff like that. I do get a little obsessive on some panels, but I'm learning to relax.
Well, some things have to do with the story. If you want to have a certain plot point visually available so that people realize that, you got to make sure that's in there. But yeah, when it comes to other stuff, you don't necessarily have to do that. But it's so good. This issue is going to be so great. It's so much fun for people to read and enjoy, particularly if you're a science fiction fan. I never understood why in Star Trek they used to say, no humor. We don't like any comedy in here. We're a very serious science fiction. And I used to always feel like we got cheated because a lot of those actors and stuff were quite funny people and they could have done some wonderful things. And yeah, so I'm glad that you get to do it because you take advantage of humor and make it just sparkle in there.
Well, thank you. One thing I would like to mention that, you know, we also offer the opportunity to get past issues either as an add-on or there's, you know, all three as a reward tier. Or if you pledge, I think it's like at the $18 or above, you'll get issues 1 and 2 has a digital copy as well on there.
Cool. See, people need to be able to do that. And I see that happening more and more with Kickstarters. They don't just say, like yours says issue number 3, but there are other ones, what they do is they'll say issues 1 through 3. They won't just say issue 3, and they're just so people know they can get the back issues and stuff like that. So that's something that I'm not sure if that's something you might want to consider, but it's something that I think if somebody looks at it and says, well, I don't have 1 and 2, I'm out, then they can actually figure that they're going to get to catch up on the story if they need to.
Yeah, that's a good idea. That's a good idea.
I just see it more and more. I'm always curious when I notice trends, and when I don't see that happen, I'm kind of like, maybe you might want to think about that. So it's always something fun to do. So it's when is the issue going to be available for people?
Well, since all the art's done, I just got to do a little bit of graphic design on it and then go through and make sure that I've gave Jorge a grammatically correct script and didn't have any errors in the dialogue. But all that will take place during the campaign time. Then after that, it's about 2 weeks to get the funds from Kickstarter. And as soon as those go in, I immediately send the files off to the printer. 2 weeks later, I get those in, and yeah, everything should be shipping out the first part of December, if I've done my math right. Hopefully in time to beat the Christmas rush.
Well, you know, there's always these paper shortages. That's the thing I worry about these days. A lot of people used to say, oh, I know exactly when my book's going to show, because it's always the case. But now paper shortages have taken all the fun out of that and made it even that you don't aren't exactly sure. But so saying December is a good idea, because you give yourself a little time. So if it doesn't show up December 1, then people won't be disappointed with that. So that'll be good.
Yeah, and so far, knocking on wood, the paper shortages haven't affected our printer. Either that, or he's very good at smuggling it into the country. So
you're lucky, because I help out with some folks on comics, and you know the hurricane that went through Florida.
Yeah,
it went right over the building where the printer was.
Oh,
and they're getting back on their feet. They're doing really well, but. What was really bad was the hurricane hit, and then it rained a couple days later.
Oh no!
On Sunday it rained, and when they went in Monday, the what they had set up to keep the what they could out had collapsed, and so another soaking hit in there. So man, I'll tell you something to do. That's why I always worry about paper shortages, because you're just not sure anymore when it comes to these things. But hopefully that it won't be a problem with you. It'll be a good thing if it doesn't happen that way.
Yeah, we were very blessed. I'd heard about those, and Mrs. Vengeance, the last Kickstarter I did, issues 1 through 3 also available as an add-on in this one. I was really afraid that hey, these paper shortages are going to affect that, but you know, fortunately our printer was able to, you know, again just come through in amazing colors and got that out.
Great. Now, speaking of Mrs. Vengeance, how are things going with that project and your other projects?
I'm still conceptualizing issue 4 in my head. I know who the villain for the next arc is going to be, and this one will be a little bit more about her as opposed to being seen through, you know, a separate party's eyes. But I'm really more working on issue 4 of Driver 8, just so I can get the season, what I consider the season, finished. And then my plan is finish up issue 4 of Driver 8, then do issue 4 of Mrs. Vengeance, and then we start up season 2 of Driver 8 with issue 5.
Great, great. So that'll be good. So about how long do you usually have between Kickstarters?
Usually I try and space them out a lot more than I did this last time with Mrs. Vengeance and Driver 8. My wife really wants her dining room back, but she can't have it back just yet. But you know, I'm hoping you will at least get 2 issues out next year. If we're really ambitious, we'll be able to get 3, but you know, 2 Driver 8 and 1 Mrs. Vengeance. We'll just have to see how everything goes. But well, the plan is at the very least to get Driver issue 4 and Mrs. Vengeance issue 4 out next year.
Well, it's always better to get the quality right rather than the quantity. So far the books have been wonderful to read, and I'm looking forward to more. Do you know how many issues of Driver 8 you have in mind?
12.
12 altogether. Okay.
Yeah.
That'll be good. So we've got a good time to, and you were thinking about collecting them when those are all done?
Oh yeah, definitely. Actually, once we get the 4th one done, I was going to see how we could get them collected into, you know, volume 1, you know, mm-hmm. We're not ready. And then season 2 is going to be, as opposed to You Are Not Ready, it's going to be You Cannot Go Back. That'll be the theme of it.
Wow, it sounds a lot of fun. It's this book has really been a great series, wonderful bit of science fiction, and you know that the business with the Men in Black and the science fiction, it's all working well together. I don't know what you're going to do. Like I said, I love that. You don't know how that for a long time reader like me, that is such a joy to have.
Thank you.
So good to see. So, all right, one last time, let's say this project will be funded when it reaches its goal on Saturday, November 19 at 7:43 p.m. Eastern Time. Of course, you've already gotten past your goal at this point. You know, barring somebody canceling a huge pledge, you should get that all pretty well done. Your backers are good numbers, and I'm very optimistic that all this stuff's going to go through really well, just like the other issues have, and we get to read more Driver 8. And I can tell you, Jerry, is this great fun. I love a book like this that twists my imagination around and makes me laugh and makes me cry, and I just don't know what you're going to do. So Driver 8 is a big success. I highly recommend, if you haven't gotten into it, be sure to go to Driver 8, issue number 3, The Strange Fate of Driver 2, and be sure to pledge on there. So, and don't wait. Do it as soon as you get done listening to this fun interview, and that'll help Jerry. He won't have to worry about, he won't have to refresh the screen again and again and again and see if anybody's pledged in the last time, which almost everybody I know who's ever done a Kickstarter does that on a very regular basis, particularly in the middle of a campaign. They're going, oh no, nobody's ever going to pledge again. But because the beginning and the end is usually when things happen, but
we don't admit that we just sit there at work with a screen open and just, you know, refresh, work, refresh, work. And then, you know, since the spelling of Driver, you know, .8, sometimes that gets a little bit hard for people. You can also just go to driver8comic.com, okay. Either with EIGHT or just the letter 8 or the number 8. And that'll take you right to the Kickstarter page as well.
All right. Speaking of that, how do people follow you on social media?
Social media, there's the Limitless Comics page. You can find me there. You can find me on Facebook under the name my mother prefers to call me, which is Jerry Jones. you can find me on Instagram at JJJ754. You can also find me on Twitter at JJJones754.
Great, great. Well, this is a huge success. I love it, and I enjoy reading it so much. And it's always great to talk with you because you always make these books to sparkle and really a joy to read. So just keep it up, Jerry. You're doing wonderful, and I can't wait to we get to Driver.8, issue number 12. I'm going to really be anxious to see how you're going to wrap all this good stuff up.
Well, thank you. I think you'll really enjoy it.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, from flesh and blood, I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
It's great to welcome to the podcast Edmund Truman, who has been creating and self-publishing underground comics for the last decade. He's got a new book that's out right now, and in certain places of the world, other places are catching up, called Postcards from Congo. And it's his first long-form graphic nonfiction work and his first dealing with African history. How are you doing, Edmund?
I'm great. Yeah, I'm really good. I'm really happy to be on the show with you. And I'm really excited to talk about the book with you.
It's good to talk with you. So let's talk a little bit about you doing underground comics before we dive into the book. What kind of if we were looking to find your books, what books should we be looking for there?
You mean like where could you find them online at the moment?
Yeah, and which ones have you done?
Okay, so for the last 10 years, I've basically just been making short stories and printing them myself. They're not available online anymore, any of the older ones, because I think a process a lot of artists go through is that they start out and their work isn't that good and it gets better over time. That's one of the reasons that I ended up coming to the underground format, is that I didn't go to any kind of art school. I just decided that it'd be nice to teach myself comics. And obviously I was aware that in the beginning, my work wasn't very good. And it was going to improve over time, but I didn't want to wait around writing stories, sending them to publishers who were unlikely to accept them, So I thought, I'm just going to do this myself. I'm going to make them and I'm going to print them and I'm going to sell them. I used to sell them at a lot of shows, a lot of concerts. I'd go to some arts festivals. So the things that I made in that period of time, you kind of had to meet me then. And when I look back, I don't really like them that much. So they're not really online anymore. The stuff I've done more recently, you can find it on Instagram. And there's still quite a lot of those things that are available. So I think if people are interested, the best thing is that they just send me a message on my Instagram. And I'm still distributing some of the more recent ones. And the older ones have been lost to the archives of time. And I'm fine with that.
Okay. It sounds a lot about how I got into podcasting. I came across it and I was like, I'd like to learn how to do that whole thing. And so I started doing it. And I do this whole process myself because I enjoy, you know, having the control of it. And I imagine that's something why you did the comics you did.
Exactly. That was the other thing that I didn't mention was I kind of just wanted to write about whatever I felt like writing about. I think that's really important when you get started as well, is just don't feel any limitations, just doing what you feel like. So a lot of the topics I was writing about were quite obscure. I was writing a lot of stuff about the kind of life I was living and the things around me. I also did a lot of quite experimental, weird, arty comics without characters or words. And I had loads of fun doing that, but there's no way that major publishers would have touched it. And I just thought, I want to do what I want to do, and I'm just going to do it like this. And over the years, they got better, and I had a lot of fun doing it. And when I arrived at this project, I thought, I think this is actually a topic a lot of people could be interested in, and a lot of people should learn about. So I thought maybe it's time to try and make that leap and go through a mainstream publisher. So that's how I ended up where I am today with the book that we're talking about.
Very cool. I always tell people, don't go back and listen to my first episode, because it was me trying to talk for 20 minutes on my own, and it was horrible. And after that, I've always spent my time interviewing people, because I think it's better when I'm talking to somebody else rather than me just prattling on. So I can relate to what you're talking about very much.
Doing something is probably not necessarily always, but it's one of the best ways of learning something. You've got to learn from your mistakes. And when you look back at that early work, it can be a bit embarrassing. A couple of days ago, I was having a conversation with a friend about a comic I'd made. It would have been 10 years ago now. And he said, oh, I'd love to see it. And I said, I've got one left in my room. I gave it to him and I said, you can have this, but you're not allowed to tell anyone who made it or who gave it to you.
Funny. That's kind of funny. Yeah, I always tell people, you can listen to all my interviews, but don't listen to that first. I just wanted to get something out there, and that's what I did.
Yeah, so exactly. That's how you learn.
Right. So Postcards from Congo, you were saying that this was a subject you became interested in. Do you want to tell a little bit about that? Because I found that I was reading the preface and the book, and it was kind of interesting how you got involved in all this. Talk about that, if you would.
So the book is about history. It's about the history of Congo, as you can guess from the title. I'm not a trained historian. I mean, in that sense, I'm also not a trained comic artist because I never went to an art school, as we just said. But I'm a big geek. I love to spend hours in my bedroom reading about different topics. And a few years ago, I just started thinking how little I knew about the history of histories that weren't spoken about to me in school and aren't generally spoken about through the main channels, through the media. Where I live in the west of Europe. And I just thought I'd love to find out about that. And I think that came from a few things. The main one was I've got, several friends here who either grew up in Africa or maybe their parents grew up in Africa. And I've been talking to them about their life experiences, the things that happened to them before they arrived in Europe. Some of them fled, various events. That's why they ended up here. And I felt quite ashamed that I didn't have any familiarity with those events. I know a lot about events that have happened in Europe. I know about the various wars that took place when Yugoslavia broke down. Of course, I know about World War II, World War I, also about history of America, because we talk about that a lot in Europe as well. I know about the Civil War. But I didn't know anything about these things that had happened within my own lifetime to people my own age. And I just thought that's a part of history I'd love to learn about. So I started distracting myself for hours on end, for days on end, and learning about history. I was just picking up everything I could find, really. And I got really stuck on the history of Congo. And when I'm talking about Congo, I'm talking about the country that's today known as the Democratic Republic of Congo. There are two countries that are colloquially named called Congo. The other one is the Republic of Congo, but I'm only talking about the Democratic Republic of Congo. It's a long story why they're both called Congo, but I won't get into that now. I got really stuck on that history because I think it's a really gripping story. It's really interesting. And I couldn't believe that no one around me had been talking about it that much already. Of course, there is loads of stuff written and there's a lot of great writing, a lot of great documentaries, but it hadn't yet entered into the mainstream dialogue here in Europe. And that really struck me, first because it's an incredibly interesting story, but also because it's a story which is really linked with our own story here in Europe, also in the United States. It's incredibly linked with things that have happened in the United States. And I thought, why is that we're not talking about this? You know, why aren't we discussing the influence this has had on our world and the influence we've had on their world? And I learned a lot about it. And I thought, this is very interesting and I'd like to share this with more people. When I started reading about this topic, obviously the history of an entire country, that's loads of information. And it's quite overwhelming to start with if you don't know very much. You know, I had some vague awareness that it was colonized by Belgium. I knew a little bit about the story of the early colonization from King Leopold II. But I didn't know much details. And it's quite overwhelming to start with. And I thought, I'd really like to make a book for people who want to get started on this and they want sort of just like a nice, easy introduction. And I don't mean easy to read because history, wherever you look at history, it always involves hard realities. It always involves wars and struggles over terrain and resources. That's everywhere in the world. But I mean easy to read in the sense that it's brief. We're trying to only cover a little bit on each topic, and because it's illustrated, it should be easier to digest than a 600-page book of just text.
Mm-hmm. It's really interesting because you've done the whole thing, right? I mean, as far as like the art you did and the composing of the text and stuff, did the font that you chose, was that based on your writing or was the one that you chose? How did you do that?
I actually used a different font. I really love the... a font which is typically used in the sort of mid-20th century European comics. But the Arsenal Pop Press told me they didn't think it was that legible. So I thought, I will trust in the professionals here. And they used a very similar font, which I like because it looks a lot like handwriting. It gives a casual feel, but it is easy to read.
Mm-hmm. And you drew the graphics, right?
Yeah. So I wrote the text and I drew all of the images. I draw everything by hand on a piece of paper, and then I do the colors and a bit of post-production on Photoshop. But I try and do as little as I can on the computer.
Okay, because it's really fascinating thing to read. Now, I think it matches. It's called Postcards from Congo because each page has like one graphic, and there's text underneath to read. So it really is like getting a postcard from somebody. I hope people really remember those days. I haven't seen many postcards in a while, but it's still something I think people will relate to because there's a lot of really good information in this. So I have to agree with you on that. This is a part of the world I know very little about. And there's another book that's out called Yi Sun Xin, which is about a part of Asia that I knew very little about. And I really... You know, it tells the story of a commander in an army over that way. And wow, I was really gripped because I learned a lot about the culture and a lot about the things that have gone on. And I felt the same thing about this book, that this book really is something you can't help but be drawn in and follow the subjects and kind of be interested to see how things turned out. And it's really well done. It raises a lot of questions in my mind. So I like something that makes me think. And this book really does a good job of that.
Yeah, I think comics are, you know, comics and illustrated books, because this book is sort of halfway between the two. There's definitely a comics-influenced style, but it's not sequential in the traditional sense. It's such a great possibility for people to learn. When I was a kid, I used to read a lot of British comics like the Beano and the Dandy. I can't think of what would be an American equivalent of that, but maybe some listeners would be familiar with it. But they're sort of like silly kids' comics. And as a kid, you're just absorbing everything. And I used to whip out a lot of trivia about world events, world history to my mother. And she said, "Where did you learn that?" And I said, "Yeah, I read it in the Dandy." And she was always amazed, because in her mind, the comic, you know, it's for kids. And it's still today perceived by most people as sort of a low art form. It's not even an art form in the minds of a lot of people. And I think that really enables us to bring educative information to an audience who might not otherwise seek it out. There are a lot of readers, and I'll include myself in this, who are unlikely to pick up academic papers or, you know, books of hundreds and hundreds of pages of text about historical information. But if you give them a comic, they will sit and they will read through it, and that same information will come into them. And I think I'm definitely not alone in picking this up now. I think it's a really interesting time in the history of comics that more and more writers and artists are turning to this. I know you did an interview with David F. Walker on his book, The Life of Frederick Douglass.
Right.
That's another great example of, you know, people are just using this medium not only to entertain, but also to teach.
Mm-hmm. I enjoy that book, and I enjoy this book too. I think I like learning about things I don't know much about, and I think this is a great thing. Now, I'm just sort of curious, when you were drawing the images, how did you decide what to make them look like, as far as like the people and the places and stuff? Did you research and find like historical references that you used?
Yeah, obviously with history, it's hard to know exactly how things looked. So I had to do a lot of research. Wherever I could, I collected as many photos as I could. I've got a hard drive full of photos from various moments in history. And wherever I could, I worked from those photos. Obviously, there's many moments when there are not photos, either of this specific event, if it was something like, you know, like a politically sensitive event. You've got the assassination of Patrice Lumumba in the book, which is documented through, you know, interviews, what people have said, but obviously there's no photos from it because it was a big inside job and it was hushed up. So you have to work with what's been written about it, impressions people have had, photos of the people who are present, but in, you know, photos of them from different moments. And then there's another side of history, which is even harder to represent accurately, which is, you know, like prehistory. There are no records. The first chapter of the book is before colonial contact with Congo was made. Well, before the Belgian colonial contact was made. So that's before the 19th century. And there's parts of that which, you know, that took place before there's any kind of written record. What we know about some of those periods of history is just taken from guesswork based on archaeological findings and linguistic evidence. So at that point, you are very much in the realm of guesswork. You can look at how things looked much later on in history in photographs or how they were described. You can look at the artifacts that have been found, but you are guessing a lot. And that's why I've included at the end of the book, sort of a reference section for the images in which I wrote why I drew each image as I did, which I think is important because I wanted readers to know in what context they were looking at the history, how much they could take what they were looking at as a reality of how things really were, or how much it is an imagined version of it. Because when you're drawing history, there's always some degree of imagination involved. So for each image, I've written a sentence or two that if the readers enjoyed that part of the book and they want to know how accurate was that image? Did things actually look like that? They can turn to that section and say, okay, so these characters are drawn directly from photos, but the setting they're in has been based on an interview from 20 years later or something like that. I mean, quite a lot of the images are from moments which are well documented, and I drew them almost directly from photographs. I just change the scenery a little bit. But
It's really great. It's really gripping, the things. Particularly, I was struck by how the poor people of the Congo were influenced by outsiders, as it were, Americans, Belgians, other people coming in and basically kind of, you know, influencing them in many ways. I felt sorry for them in some ways. They never really asked for that. And yet, because of the resources that were there, they became a target of sorts for other cultures. And as hard as some of them tried to be like those people so they could be accepted by them, it didn't seem to work out for them many times. So I felt badly for them. You know, as hard as they tried, they still could never really, you know, be part of the groups that were there kind of running the show over them. I felt sorry for them in that way.
Yeah, I mean, the history of Congo, similar to the history of a lot of colonized nations, has been, well, the history since the 19th century has been absolutely tattered by external forces seeking to extract materials with absolutely no mercy for the well-being of the people who live around those materials. And one of the, if there's two messages I wanted to give with this book, one of them is that the ill fate that has come across the people of Congo so many times has come directly because people from the rest of the world, particularly Belgium, also the United States, more recently China, but really a lot of places, has come because those people have come to the Congo and treated people really, really badly, a huge cost of human life, purely for the extraction of resources and for economic gain of their own countries. The other message that I wanted to give from the book was that the Congolese people, although they have suffered this, they have not taken it lying down, and they have on many, many occasions risen up and taken matters into their own hands to try and fight back against this enormous external forces which they've been fighting against. And I think it's a story of tragedy that people have been treated in this way, but there's also a very inspiring element that these people have continued to fight to have the best life they could, the same as people everywhere in the world.
The one thing that really stood out to me, as I was mentioning, they started to dress up like the Europeans and other people who were there. And then later on, when they gained independence, they outlawed all that. They said, no, you don't dress up like those people. You dress in other ways. And they renamed things and took off the names, which, of course, in some levels, America is in the middle of. So there's a lot of stuff that we can learn as to what we're doing today out of their history, because they seem to be going through this ahead of us.
Yeah, definitely. And you spoke about the Congolese people attempting to assimilate Western cultural values during that period of colonialism. Something that happened in Congo, which happened in a lot of African countries during colonization, was that sometime in Congo, it happened in the 1940s and 1950s, but it would have been different in different places. An educated, would have been middle class, arose. I can't say they were really middle class, because they were never arose to the economic level of that, because they weren't given access to jobs. But an educated class arose. And initially, in the late 1940s, early 1950s, the aims of that class were just to join the Belgian colonizers at the top of the stack. They didn't want to eradicate colonialism. They just wanted to emulate, let's say, their masters and join them at the top of the pile. The mistake that was made by the Belgian colonial powers, and the same as all the colonial powers in Africa in that time, was that they refused to give that access. And so these people grew impatient and they demanded a total deconstruction of the colonial system, which is what happened with the help of a massive, unruly working class who were simply dissatisfied. And those were the people who were willing to go to the streets and start the unrest, which eventually put pressure on the Belgian government to give up the colony. And at the time they did that, there was already a huge bloody colonial war going on in Algeria. And I think it's fair to say that the Algerians, they fought for their own independence, but they also fought for the independence of the whole continent, because when the colonial powers of Europe saw what was going on in Algeria, nobody wanted to repeat that. And I think that was a big thing that led to the decolonization of Africa at the end of the 1950s, start of the 1960s.
Mm-hmm. The thing that discouraged me the most was when they get independence, then the governments that were getting installed, they did the same thing as the outside people did. They took advantage of their own people, you know, becoming wealthy in their own rights, but not really, you know, letting the roads fall apart, letting all these things not go well while they became independently wealthy. And I felt so bad. These poor people are just getting taken advantage of, even by their own leaders, as well as people who are outside. And I wish that could have been stopped sooner.
Yeah, definitely. It was. The tragedy kept on going, and it's still ongoing today. And there's definitely an element where we can talk about the idea of sort of intergenerational trauma that people reproduce. The way in which they've been treated, they reproduce it themselves when they enter into a position of power. But I think another big reason for the continuation of that bad treatment at the hands of the new Congolese leaders was that the colonial influence never really left. I mean, what happened all over Africa and in Congo especially was that colonialism ended officially around 1960, but as soon as colonialism was gone, post-colonialism, as we call it, arised. So you didn't anymore have an officially recognized ruler of the country. In this case, Belgium was officially off the scene. But there was huge influence from the United States, coming from the CIA and also from the Belgian intelligence, which kept in power the leaders who were on their side. And those were the leaders who let those roads fall apart, who massacred people, who put down any attempt at democracy. So when we talk about the continued tragedy, which was faced at the hands of the new generation of Congolese leaders following the independence, we're really talking about a continued tragedy under the influence of those same powers who officially were off the scene.
Mm-hmm. It just made me so sad to see these things. And, you know, it just seemed to swing from the pendulum in one way to the other. I felt so sorry for the average person. You know, there were gangs that were going around and killing people, and the hospitals would stop and stuff like that. And I was amazed at all the different things that you pointed out that took place over the years. The hanging of four people at the beginning of one guy's rule. And I just felt so bad for these, you know, all these people. They tried and tried and tried really hard, and they would have revolutions and things like that, but it never seemed to resolve things. And you're right. Even today, it seems like there needs to be somehow, some way to benefit the average Congolese. It would be a great thing.
Definitely. Yeah, I mean, definitely something needs to be done to benefit them. I think the first and most important step is for foreign powers to butt out of it, basically. I mean, the continued unrest in the east of Congo today, it's no secret that that's coming at the hands of their neighboring country, Rwanda. And that it's a question of economics. If Rwanda weren't able to send in puppet militias to cause terror, they wouldn't be able to extract materials from Congo, which they don't have to pay any tax on. And if the international market weren't buying those materials, then that situation would be gone. But the story continues today, as it started in Congo in the late 19th century, that across the world, the people care more about the cheap materials than they care about the lives of the people in the places where they're getting them from. And it's absolutely not a unique situation to Congo. That's happening all over the world. Even within our own countries, that's happening. If you look at the living conditions of, you know, the working classes or minority groups in the United States, also in the West of Europe, it's maybe not as severe, but it's a similar story, you know?
Mm-hmm. It's something to really to read about, and to there were so many facts and stuff. I said, I want to remember that, but there were so many, my brain just couldn't hold them all. So I'm going to have to reread this and try to hang on some more. of the things. The one, for example, that I really got a kick out of was when the last Ebola patient was discharged, and to celebrate, they like danced in the streets.
Yeah, it's absolutely beautiful. There's a, I believe at the back of the book, I put a link of where you can watch that. It was a Twitter post of the moment when the last Ebola patient was discharged, and all of the doctors did a parade through the streets celebrating. That was in the second largest outbreak of Ebola so far. So it was after the really big outbreak in West Africa that happened a couple of years earlier. And it was really a moment, you know, it was a success with the help of the WHO, but it was really a success of the Congolese people as well. They had an instrumental role in the end of that outbreak. Both Congolese doctors who came from across the country to help, doctors and nurses. And also there was a huge team of local volunteers who were taking part in contract tracing. One of the reasons that that Ebola outbreak got so out of hand is because there's still conflict in that part of the country. Rebel groups are wreaking havoc and moving from village to village. So in many moments of the outbreak, the contract tracers would have to go out of their town during a moment of conflict and check at the houses of people that they were there, inform them if they've had contact with an Ebola patient or not. So they were putting their own lives at risk to put that outbreak under control. So it was really a moment of Congolese success. And I think it was, as you said, it was absolutely beautiful to see that celebration. I saw that video quite late in the writing process, and it made me smile so much I decided it had to go in the book.
It's amazing, because we wouldn't do that here in the States. We would just breathe a sigh of relief and get on with our business. But to see them celebrate was really something kind of special. And it says a lot about the people. I think that they can't contain their joy when something like that happens, so they have to get out and celebrate. And I thought that really said a lot about the Congolese to see that.
Yeah. It was a really beautiful moment. And one of the sad things is that happened exactly at the start of the coronavirus pandemic, and it kind of got eaten by that news. All of the international news was talking about the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic, and it was very, very low on the list of the news reports that the Congolese had managed to put an end to the second biggest Ebola outbreak of history.
Uh-huh. Now, I was just sort of curious, and I know it's like asking somebody to pick out the favorites of their children, which is hard to do. Were there segments that you thought stood out that you would like people, if they get access to the book, to be able to look over in particular, to look for? What things do you think that people would benefit most from reading in your book?
It's definitely hard to choose. I think almost every page on the book could have been its own book. You know, I've tried to give like a general overview of the history, and I think it was very hard to boil things down this much. There's a couple of pages that I really like, and I would like to explore it more myself, but it's already been explored so well by other writers and comic artists that there's nothing more to say on it from my part. But that is, there's two stories in the second chapter. Oh, no, one's in the first chapter. The first story is about a man named Otto Benga. This man was a Mbuti. These are hunter-gatherers who live in the rainforest in the northeast of the country. They've maintained their hunter-gatherer lifestyle until the modern day in some cases. Sadly, in the last few decades, a lot of them have been forced to stop that hunter-gatherer lifestyle against their own will due to the continuing modern world and the conditions that are coming to them with deforestation and conflict. So Otto Benga was one of these people. He lived as a hunter-gatherer. He was captured into slavery by East African slave traders, and he was bought out of that slavery by an American quote-unquote explorer in 1906. He was taken to the Brooklyn Zoo, and at this point in time, human zoos were a very popular attraction in the United States and in the West of Europe. It's a horrible chapter of the past in which people were taken from all over the world, mostly colonized parts of the world, and exhibited in zoos as if they would be wild animals. Usually they would be placed in some kind of exhibit, which was a recreation of supposed to be a recreation of the kind of background they would come from, a village or something. In the case of Otto Benga, he was taken to the Brooklyn Zoo and placed in the monkey house with a group of orangutans, where spectators jeered at him, threw coins at him, made monkey noises, and generally humiliated him. It created a huge scandal. He was taken in by a religious group, but I believe they were Baptists, but I might have remembered that wrong. He lived in the United States. They tried to assimilate him in the American society, which was very hard for him, if you can imagine that you've grown up as a hunter-gatherer and your life is, you know, based around your traditions, your culture, hunting, and now you're taken into essentially an urban environment. The Mbuti, a lot of them sharpen their teeth. That's part of their culture, so they have pointed teeth. He was taught English. He was given caps to put on his teeth, and he became very depressed. He tried to return to Congo. He was taken back there at some point, but the people who took him there took him to a totally different part of the country. And remember that the national borders of Congo were decided by colonial powers. They weren't decided by the people who lived there. So it's the equivalent of if you were from New York, someone took you away and then they brought you back to Seattle and said, you're home now. They took him back to a totally different part of the country. He didn't know anyone. He wasn't assimilated in that culture. He couldn't speak the language. So he decided to return to America, where he continued to be depressed. He harvested a dream to return back to his true homeland. But in the outbreak of World War I, all of the shipping transit across the Atlantic Ocean was put on hold. And he took himself into the forest and he sadly killed himself in 1916. So that's a story of, that would be one of the first people who crossed that ocean, not to be taken into slavery, but supposedly to be assimilated into the society. But the way in which he was assimilated was based on a grotesque, dehumanizing spectation of his life, basically, an inaccurate version of his life. It's sort of a twin story with something that happens in the next chapter with a man called Paul Panda Farnana, who was taken to Belgium 6 years earlier in 1900. And he was taken to be given an education by a group of, by a family of very, for their time, very progressive thinking aristocratic Belgians. These were well-off educated people. They took him in 1900. He was given an education. He graduated in agriculture, so he was the first Congolese to receive a university degree in Europe. When World War I broke out, he volunteered himself to fight on the Belgian side. He was captured and was a prisoner of war, which he was eventually released from at the end of the war. He became a very well-educated member of Belgian society. He learned to play the piano. He'd already been playing an instrument back when he was in Congo. He was playing a Congolese instrument. He learned to play the piano. He spoke at the first Pan-African Congress in Belgium and at the Colonial Congress, which was a meeting of essentially imperialists, rich and wealthy European imperialists, talking about how their colonial enterprise would continue. And he spoke at that conference and basically told them that more rights need to be given to the people who you're ruling over, and they have a right to have a quality of life as well. He was applauded for that speech. Obviously, no changes were made in response to that. But you can see the difference in fate of these two people who lived basically at the same time on the nature of the respect they were given and the treatment they were given when they were taken to this strange faraway land. Paul Panda Farnana tragically died about 10 years after he gave that speech. He returned to Congo and he died in mysterious circumstances. There is a really good comic already about his life. I have no association or sponsorship from the people who made this comic, by the way. But there is a really good comic about it, which I'm going to plug, called Paul Panda Farnana, A Forgotten Life. It's only available in French, so the name is Une Vie Oubliée. And it's by Asimba Bathy, Jemba Jace, Dodi Lobela, Yann Kumbosi, and Antoine Chitungu. I've obviously got my bookshelf next to me. I couldn't remember all of those names otherwise. But it's an amazing book, and I would recommend it to anyone who wants to dig deeper on one of the topics featured in my book.
It's such a great book. I mean, I could read this multiple times and still learn some new stuff out of it, because there's so much to pick up and understand. I just It's that part you mentioned about the putting the guy in the cage out for display. That was so aggravating. I was so mad at it about that when I read that. And there's exhilarating parts when things go really well, and there's parts that just make you want to throw things at people because it's just so awful that happens. So it's one of those great books that just takes you all over the place and helps you understand some of what's going on. It's just fascinating book. So well done. I hope people get a chance to read it because it's so worth it. But there's one thing I wanted to ask you about for sure. You mentioned at the beginning you were planning to go to the Congo, but of course the pandemic rose up just about that time. Are you still planning to go there? Would you still like to go and visit the country?
Yeah, absolutely. That's the project that I'm working on at the moment. I'm saving up now. It's not especially cheap for me to get there, but I'm working on that at the moment. Originally, I had a different idea for the project, which would have been based more on basically participant research, hands-on research. But the time when I started reading about this was when the pandemic broke out. I'm already quite a bedroom dweller. And as all, I think a lot of comic fans are bedroom dwellers, so I think a lot of listeners can relate to this. When the pandemic broke out, I became more of a bedroom dweller, and I thought, I need to write a book which I can write from here. So this book is not based on firsthand research. It's based on a lot of things I've read, a lot of, also, there's some great documentaries out there as well for people who don't want to pick up big books, but it was based on a lot of things I've read. I tried to read as much as I could from Congolese authors, particularly George Nzongola Natalaya and Didier Gondola, who provided the excellent preface to this book. My French isn't that great, and I find it hard to read a dense book in French, so that did limit the amount I could read from Congolese writers who mostly write in French language. But I tried to write the best book that I could given these conditions. So that is the book that I've created. So rather than being a book based on first-hand research, it's an attempt at summarizing and simplifying a very big topic. Now that's complete, and now it seems like the travel conditions are calming down. Definitely my next plan is to go out there myself. And I've got a couple of topics that I'd really love to dig deeper into. As I said before, almost every page of this book could have its own book. And there's a couple which I'm really looking forward to getting deeper into.
Oh, I'd love to read those. Those would be fun because based on this book, and by the way, this book is the version I got, which was an electronic version, was 184 pages, and I could not put it down. It was just great, great reading. And so you're talking about exploring some of the past subjects. Have you considered doing maybe like a book about how the Congo country is now and the people, the Congolese? Because I think that would be an interesting, you know, afterwards. Much as I'd love to, you're right, though, every page could be its own book. But what about like today's culture and where people are today? Would that be something that might interest you to write about?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I'd love to do. I think the sort of thing I've got in mind is there's some events. I'm not going to say exactly what I'm planning on because I don't want to ruin the surprise. But there's some events from the 1990s and the 2000s that I'd really like to look into. And I think you can really tie that in with the modern day. And I think as much as people need, you know, it's a really good time for people to start learning more about the history of Africa. It's also a great time for people to start learning more about what's going on there right now. The information and the news about what goes on in Africa is very minimal in the Western world. You have to scroll down a lot on your news feed. Maybe on some news channels, there's a specific section for Africa, but the headlines are very limited. And I think it's a really great time for us to start paying more attention to that. There's a lot of voices around the world, the whole, you know, all the international community, but especially the Western world at the moment, saying it's time to, you know, end racism. We had the Black Lives Matter movement exploding a couple of years ago. And I think my interest in this topic is not so much a personal interest, but it's part of, let's say, like a zeitgeist of this time. A lot of people are looking to start paying more attention to what's going on in other parts of the world. And I think the present day is, well, it's the present. It's the bit that's happening right now.
Mm-hmm. I like this. See, I'm a big buff on learning about cultures and history, and also what's happening today, I think, is so interesting. I think you're right on target with that. There's so much. This is, you know, I'm so glad I got to read this book, because there's so much that I learned about that part of the world that I did not know about, and I love nothing better than that. So I really have to tell you, I really enjoyed this book. It's terrific. I highly recommend it. If you have any interest at all, and even if you don't, you should probably get in and dive into it, because there's so much that you're going to understand and learn from it. And like I said, you're going to be infuriated at times, and other times you want to dance in the street like they did, and too. So it's just a fantastic book, and something that I really hope people, you know, get down and read into and just enjoy it, because we live in a big world, and I don't think we even scratch the surface most of the time, but this helps get going on that process. So I just have to congratulate you. It's just a wonderful book.
Oh, that's amazing. Thanks so much. It's really nice to hear your enthusiasm.
It's good. Now, are there other projects you're working on that we should be aware of?
At the moment, I'm doing a collaboration together with a group called Petroglyph Comics. That's a small comics collective who make comics on social or political issues based on academic research. So at the moment, I'm doing one which is about the experience of refugee families who settle in the UK. In that project, I'm only illustrating, which is quite nice, because it leaves my mind free to think about the future projects I'm going to research and write myself. So I'm doing that right at this moment. And I'm just starting work together with a friend on a project based around the neighborhood where we've both been living in Barcelona. And it's about how gentrification has affected the different groups of people who live in that neighborhood. And I'm working together with someone who's a qualified anthropologist. So we're going to be doing sort of ethnographic research techniques. As I said, I'm not really an expert in anything. So that's why it's really great to collaborate and use the knowledge of other people to create something better. I think what I'm good at is drawing and storytelling. So that's what I'll be bringing to the table. So cool. That's something that's going on now at the moment as well. And it's still in the research phase. We're going to be doing an online conference about it in a couple of weeks, on November the 16th, and it's called Comic Ethnographies, Graphic Narratives and Social Justice Research. So we'll be talking with a few other people who are making comics about, social justice issues.
Great, great. Are you on social media at all? Can people follow you, what you're doing on there?
I'm really bad at online stuff. I'm really not a fluent social media user, but I do have an Instagram account. It's @junk_comics, comics with an X, as in underground comics. So you can follow me on Instagram. That's the limit of my social media engagement. I know I should be better at it, but I'm much more at home with a piece of paper, sadly.
Well, that's okay. That's, you know, the world is a diverse place, and we got all people on all different levels and all different stages. So I just have to, again, recommend this book. It's called Postcards from Congo. And it's just one of those books that, if you're like me, you're not going to be able to put down, because it was so good. It's published by Arsenal Pulp Press. And if your local shop can't order it, I'm sure you can find it like on Amazon and places. And again, I recommend you buy and read this book, because you're going to learn a lot, and it's going to help you expand your horizons and the world around you, I think, your understanding. So it's just a terrific book all around, just amazingly full of chock full of great information and illustrations. So I think you did a beautiful job with this book.
Oh, thanks so much. It's really nice to hear your kind words. And thanks for having me on. It's been really nice talking to you about this.
And that's it for this week. Be back next time. We'll have another great interview with another terrific comics creator. But until then, keep reading your comics.